What's the easiest choice you can make? Window instead of middle seat? Picking a vendor who sends a great gift basket? Outsourcing business tasks you hate? What about selling with Shopify? Whether you're selling a little or a lot, Shopify helps you do your thing, however you cha-ching. Shopify is the global commerce platform that helps you sell at every stage of your business. From the launch your online shop stage to the first real-life store stage, all the way to the did-we-just-hit-a-million-orders stage, Shopify's there to help you grow. Whether you're selling scented soap or offering outdoor outfits, Shopify helps you sell. Wherever and whatever you're selling, Shopify's got you covered. Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/try. Go to shopify.com/try now to grow your business, no matter what stage you're in. Shopify.com/try.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.
What's up, ladies and gentlemen, boys and girls around the world? I would like to welcome you back to another episode of the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Now, on today's episode, we have got on a guest who I've been looking forward to speaking to for a long time. We plan to do multiple podcasts, but we've both been traveling and it's been a struggle to find where our times align. But here we are. She is a great thinker, a great writer, and a very interesting person who I can't wait to tell you about. And this is the one and only Africa Brooke. Welcome to the show.
Thank you so much. And yes, you're right. I think you and I have been trying to do this maybe for the past 3 months, something like that. But as always, I think everything happens exactly when it needs to. And I have just come back from Zimbabwe, as we were talking about, after 21 years of not being from the land that I'm from. And I feel a sense of being revitalized, and I feel more grounded, and I feel more, I feel more affirmed in my message and the work that I do. So I actually believe that the conversation you and I are about to have is very timely, and it's happening at just the right time. But thank you so much for even having me on here. I'm so excited.
It's an honor. So I know that there will be some listeners who are familiar with you, but there will be a lot of people who aren't. So tell them a little bit about yourself.
Yes. So in terms of what I like to think of as the chosen labels that I wear in the world in terms of the work that I do, I'm a consultant and I'm a mentor and I'm a speaker and a writer as well. And the main two pillars that I focus on in my work are self-sabotage and self-censorship. And I have been publicly sharing, especially when it comes to self-sabotage, for the past 6 years. And that started with me sharing my own journey of trying to get sober when I was in my 20s, when I was 24 years old. I had relapsed 7 times and I had nowhere else to turn to apart from writing. So I started an anonymous journal on Instagram where I would just share my downfalls. Anytime that I wanted to pick up a drink or smoke something or snort something, I would write about it. And I used that as a form of accountability. And I just fell into the world of psychology from then, the world of self-improvement and psychology very specifically, because I wanted to understand what was keeping me in my own cycle of self-destruction. And my platform, which I never thought of as a platform at the time, it was just an open journal because it was my only option for me to hold myself accountable publicly. I ended up building a platform that became quite big very quickly. I think because of my age at the time, being 24 and wanting to understand why I was in this cycle of relapsing, and I was doing this quite publicly, I think it was just something quite unique at the time. And my work then evolved into understanding different areas of self-sabotage, which is essentially when you get in your own way. And over the years, it has become a focus on self-censorship as well, because even in my own story with sobriety, I realized that I was withholding certain ideas and certain thoughts and certain opinions that I had around addiction, wanting to get sober, around the self-help industry, the things that I was seeing, but I was censoring a lot of my own true thoughts out of fear of what people think. So self-censorship is something that I was also exploring almost indirectly with the work that I've been doing. Then a couple of years ago, which I think is where most people would know me from, a couple of years ago, I just started to notice something that was happening culturally that reminded me of self-sabotage in and of itself. And I refer to it as collective sabotage, mm-hmm. where suddenly people were starting to behave in ways that went very much against what they said that they were for. And I was always someone that was an advocate for progression, an advocate for social justice, as in true social justice, an advocate for honest activism, an advocate for tough conversations. It's something I've been doing in my career for the past 6 years. But I realized that it was becoming increasingly difficult to ask questions. It was becoming very difficult to have important conversations. We were becoming even more divided, but it was being positioned as progress. And I realized that even though I was a very confident person, I was afraid to say these things out loud. I was terrified, and I wouldn't be able to tell you who I was actually afraid of. I just knew that there was something that was preventing me from speaking. And that because of the identities that I wear in the world as a Black person, as a woman, as someone that is more left-leaning, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, that means I shouldn't question things. So again, as someone that has been really trying to understand the psychology of self-sabotage and self-censorship through my own personal experience and with the work I do with my clients, I realized that I was actually equipped to look at this from a very different perspective. I was equipped to look at this from a psychological perspective, which I think what was happening was an attack on people's psychology for many reasons, and I'm sure we'll speak about it. But I ended up writing an open letter called Why I'm Leaving the Cult of Wokeness. And in that letter, I put all of my what I call unthinkable thoughts. I put everything in there and I left nothing on the table. And that letter was just supposed to be for my own peace of mind. It was for my own integrity. It was for me to release the things that I had been harboring for the past few years. And I thought it would be read just by the 5,000 people, which is still a lot of people that were on my newsletter, which I never really shared anything on. But then I realized that by leaving it on my newsletter, I'm still playing it safe. I have to share this publicly. Again, I didn't think about where it would end up, but I think the timing of this was also something that influenced the 7 million people that ended up reading this letter. I posted it on the 1st of January, 2021. And a few days later, January the 6th came. So the timing of that letter and the division I was speaking about and the manipulation that was happening that I was seeing resonated with a lot of people. So I think a lot of people listening to this, or a lot of people that have encountered my work in the past couple of years, would have found me through that open letter that I wrote. But maybe some people have been following my work for the past 6 years and they've seen that process of me evolving the conversation from it being about self-sabotage and then collective sabotage. So that's in a nutshell, in a very long nutshell, that's me and what I do and how you and I have ended up here together today.
That's a lot there. So, man, there's so many different directions that I feel we could go in. Before we go in depth on some of the stuff you just talked about, I'm curious to know a little bit more about your background. So you talked a little bit about being from Zimbabwe and then growing up more in the UK, and then you sort of jumped to some things that were happening in your 20s. But give us a little bit more of a picture of everything leading up, say, from zero to mid-20s when you started going on this journey.
Yeah. So I was born and raised in Zimbabwe.
Okay.
And it's still the place that I call home. When someone asks me where I'm from, it's what comes out of my mouth. I'm Zimbabwean, and it's the language that I speak with my family, Shona, at home. It's embedded in who I am. But I left when I was quite young. When I was 9 years old, we moved to the UK because it was also at the time where Zimbabwe economically and politically, it was very much on a decline in the late 90s, early 2000s. So for my mother, it was very important for us to start a life somewhere else because it just wasn't working in the country that we lived in. And she was in
You
a
were becoming
very
billionaires. You were becoming billionaires and trillionaires far too quickly.
Right, far
Yeah,
too
far
quickly.
too.
There was far too quickly. There was a point in time, Zuby, when to buy a loaf of bread, you needed a wheelbarrow because that's how much money you needed. There was it's
Yeah.
in insanity.
Yeah, I
Insanity.
when I was in school, I remember in my teens having some friends, a couple friends from Zimbabwe
Yeah.
when I was in school, and I remember them coming into class and showing us these like $500 billion notes and trillion dollar. We were all just confused. This is back when I think I'd sort of heard of inflation, but didn't
Yeah,
really know what it meant.
didn't
And
really understand what it
yeah.
meant, right? So, exactly. So, for those reasons and many other reasons, my mother, who was pretty much leading our family at that point in time, I have two older sisters and one younger brother. She just knew that we had to leave the country to start a different and much better life somewhere else. And at the time, it was much easier to come to Britain than it is now. And I'm really grateful that everything that happened in my life happened when it did, because my life would look very different, which is why I also speak in the way that I do about things like oppression, etc., which I'm sure we'll speak about at some point. But at a very young age, came to the UK, and a big piece of that, as in why my mother was leading the family, is because my father was completely incapable of doing so anymore. He was an alcoholic. A very serious alcoholic. By the time I was 7, 8, 9 years old, he was a completely different man to the man that I had grown up with in my younger years. And it was a two-parent household. My parents were married. We had a wonderful, wonderful home. I had a brilliant upbringing. We were by no means wealthy or anything like that. We were working class family, but at that time in Zimbabwe, even if you were working class, you lived quite a good, comfortable life because you were supported by the government and the system until the late 90s when things started changing quite a lot. So my dad couldn't lead the family anymore. Alcoholism was pretty much ruling his life at that point. And the plan was for him to follow on to the UK at some point, but he ended up passing away in 2004. So my mum ended up being the sole parent and trying her very, very best to take care of all four of us. But for me, by the age of 14, I started to repeat a lot of the patterns that my father had caught himself in. And one of those things was drinking. The sort of drinking patterns that he would engage and exhibit, I adopted the very same things from the age of 14. And this is something that I say all the time, but I think culturally here in the UK, and I wonder what you think about this, drinking is just seen as a rite of passage, especially when you're a young person, whether you're 13, 14, 15, 16, it's just seen as, it's what everyone does. So there's never, unless it's at the far extreme, it's very difficult for people to see that you need help. But for me, I blacked out the very first time that I drank, which maybe some people think, okay, that's no big deal. If you drink a lot, you're very likely to black out. But it happened from that moment on, it happened almost every single time that I drank. Because binge drinking is the type of drinking that I was training. It's the type of drinking that I'd seen with my father's friends, when, we would, back in Zimbabwe, when my sister and I would be walking from school and we see my father and his friends sitting on the side of the road just drinking. That was the way to drink. It was not having just one glass or enjoying the taste. I just didn't know that it could look like that. So that pattern and that way of drinking followed me up until I was 24. From the age of 14 up until 24, when I got sober, I relapsed 7 times. And that's not counting the times in between when I would do something so shameful and just tell myself that I'm not going to drink again. Those 7 times I had really, really hit rock bottom. And I would go for periods thinking that, okay, I think I've got this. It's been 3 months, it's been 6 months, it's been 7 months. I think I do this. And for me, that was a very revealing time for so many reasons. Not only because I was able to see my father in myself in a way that I never thought I would, but because I started to really see what loss looks like in terms of losing relationships, in terms of losing yourself mentally, emotionally, spiritually. And I didn't have the language that I have right now. I didn't think about the psychology behind it. I didn't think about the patterns of my father. I didn't think about what's happening on a brain-based level. To me, I was just a shameful person. I was just a bad person. I was always going to be like this. So by the time I was 24, so that's sort of my journey. For those 10 years, Zubi, there's not really much else that I could say. It was just a pattern of partying, drinking, having sex, partying, drinking, having sex, feeling ashamed, hiding myself away, trying to create a new identity, promising that I would change, and then repeating the very same things over and over and over and over again for a decade. So that very last time when I was 24, people always ask, so what was the moment that you decided that, okay, this is the last time? There wasn't even a specific kind of moment. It was just I always think of it as a spiritual exhaustion. And I think there are people, when you're just so tired, spiritually tired of being in the same place, sometimes it doesn't take a profound, loud event. It's almost just like a knowing that, okay, now it's time. And for me, part of me acknowledging and honoring that knowing was then me sharing publicly online, which I started doing in 2016, and then it's evolved from there. But that was sort of the journey that I took from 9 years old up until 14, being introduced to alcohol, and then the 10 years that followed.
I hear that. When you were, say, especially 14, 15, because that strikes me as pretty young.
Yeah.
How did you get involved in that? Was that a social thing? Were you hanging around a lot of friends and people who were influencing you in that direction? Was it something that you were, because I'm trying to think of, I know teenagers, of course, can hide things from their parents, but of course you've got your parents, you've got your siblings as well. How were you kind of doing that without, was that something they were concerned about, or did you hide it from them?
Right.
What did that look
like? Yeah, so it was the most interesting thing about my upbringing, especially with the part that alcohol played, was that the only person in my family who even drank alcohol was my father. My mother does not drink. She never has. She was quite a religious woman as we were growing up. She was very religious. Not strictly so, but religion was a big part of her life. So her life philosophy didn't include alcohol. And my siblings, they never drank either. So in our home, there was no alcohol. By the time we had moved to the UK, because my father wasn't present and he was the only person drinking, there was nothing like that. So it's not even like I had picked it up from this new environment that we were in and it was surrounding me. No, not at all. Even with family, extended family, being Zimbabwean, being from a Christian home, it just means that no one really drinks as much, you know. So it's definitely something that I picked up socially from school. It's something that I found. I've always had quite a rebellious nature. I've always just naturally as a person wanted to know why I can't do something. Why is something wrong? Why am I not allowed to do it? You know, the more you tell me I'm not allowed to do it, the more I will want to do it. The more you tell me that it's bad, the more I will want to find out for myself why it's bad, or the more exciting it will be, the more thrilling it will be. So by the time that, you know, I was just hanging out with friends in the park at that age, it just felt like, okay, yeah, I do want to try this thing. I can see someone maybe next to me swaying, maybe they're stumbling their words a little bit, but people are laughing, it's fun. So I think it was quite it seemed quite natural for me to just join in. I didn't even ask any questions. And when I saw what it could do to my state of mind, that it could make me forget that I was feeling insecure, it would make me not even consider that I am the only Black person in my entire group of friends, because we were living in Kent at the time as well, in the early 2000s. So it was very different. It was not like London, where it's very diverse. It's an obvious sense of, you know, diversity in that sense. So alcohol just kind of made me feel like I could perfectly fit in without any sort of friction. But it's definitely something that was social, and it continued to be something that I used as a non-negotiable social tool,
It's interesting, because I actually have a lot of thoughts and considerations about this, given my own personal stance and also my own upbringing, because as you probably know, I grew up in Saudi Arabia. So I grew up in a dry country, not just in terms of the temperature, but I grew up in a place where alcohol is illegal. It's banned. Right. It's generally not part at all of the society, of the culture, and so on. Yes, of course, there are people who are able to get their hands on alcohol in Saudi Arabia and other Middle Eastern countries, but it's just, I grew up with it not even, just not being a thing. And then I went to boarding school from the age of 11 in the UK. So from 11 and then up until 20 in university, I was in the UK, but still flying back and forth between the UK and Saudi Arabia. So I've certainly seen British drinking culture up front and personal for many decades at this point. I personally don't drink. I don't drink at all. I stopped drinking completely. I never drank a lot, but I drank a little bit from, I guess, around 15 to 22. And then at 22, 23, I've just been completely, you know, like just teetotal. Just no, you know, I'm not even interested. I was never that interested to begin with. I've never had a hangover. I've certainly never blacked out or anything like that. Even when I did drink, I was never someone who really liked it, but I was just like, no, this is, I'm not into this. But I personally think, and some people won't like me saying this, I think that the UK in general, British culture has a globally, to be honest, this is an internationally known thing. British people around the world are known for this binge drinking culture and this drunkenness culture. And I love the UK, but I think that that is one mark on it that people don't like being open and honest about. I think that there are a very high number of functional alcoholics in the UK. I think that there are people with, and I'll tell you how I see this. When I see people boasting that they've gone a week without a drink, or when people are doing things like dry January or sober October, and I'm like, it shouldn't be, going a week without a drink shouldn't be an achievement, bro.
Right.
Like that's not, I'm like, that's not a long time. Or some people, oh, 3 days without alcohol. And I'm like, what? Because to me, alcohol is a drug. It is a drug. It's a socially acceptable drug. And it's weird because if I say I don't drink, everyone asks me why. If I say I don't do coke or I don't smoke weed even, or no one asks me why or wants me to justify my position or whatever.
Right.
But if I say I don't drink alcohol, people look at you like you're weird. It really puts you in the minority. I don't feel compelled to explain myself unless I want to, but the way that it's sort of treated, or the fact that you can go to a club or a bar or something in the UK and the dance floor is just empty. All right. Dance floor is empty and people, oh, I need to drink. I can't dance. Right? I need to drink more. Or, oh, I can't talk to that person I'm attracted to because I'm not drunk yet, or so on. And I'm like, that's weird. And that's not a global thing around the world.
Yes.
You shouldn't need to be drunk to dance. You shouldn't need to be drunk to socialize. Sure. If you want to have a couple drinks and it loosens you up a little bit, that's one thing. But for it to be something you need in order to do things that are just sort of normal and basic and fun, to me, that's a concern. And, you know, some people might hear that and be like, oh, you're being judgmental or whatever. I don't care. I do think that that is abnormal. I don't think that that is healthy. I think that if you struggle to go a few days or a few weeks or even a month, I think if you struggle to go a month without alcohol, certainly a week, I think you have some type of addiction and
Absolutely.
Reliance, and no one wants to admit that they have that, but I think that's honestly the case.
I agree, and I'm so glad that you said that and you've articulated that perfectly, because when I finally did get sober at 24, I felt like I was starting all over again, because even to just relate to people, it felt very difficult, because I always felt, and I had trained myself to believe, that I needed that lubricant to have a conversation, to flirt with someone, to dance, to be more expressive. I felt like something was always missing for such a long time. Actually, for the first year in my sobriety, I still felt like something was missing, because I had trained myself to just get a drink, and it's everywhere. As you're saying, it's everywhere. It's not as if you have to jump through any kind of hoop to get alcohol. No, it's quite literally everywhere, which is why I commend people who have either never drunk before, who drunk and decided, you know what, I actually don't like this. People who have managed to get sober, because the access to it is so easy. So yeah, I think what you're saying is actually very important, because it makes you believe that to do the most normal things, you need alcohol and you couldn't possibly do it. So I think it's a very big cultural thing. And when you go around the world, and I'm sure as you have, you've gone to many different environments, met people of so many different cultures, you do realize that actually this is a uniquely cultural thing, a very British thing. So yeah, but I was able to be with that discomfort of trying to find my feet again without alcohol, and then realizing how much credit we give to things outside of us.
I actually have a little bit of a theory on why I think it's like that in the UK. I have a theory that in British society and British culture, people are on average are quite reserved. People are quite reserved and restrained and very polite in a keeping to themselves kind of way. British culture in general is not very, British people are not known for being particularly expressive and, extroverted, and people kind of keep to themselves. And a lot of colder countries have this. I mean, funnily enough, I think it seems to even be related to the climate of a country. It seems that people from colder places, whether it's the UK or even Northern European countries, Scandinavia, Russia, so on, they're more reserved and a little bit cold in that way. Not in a harsh way, just of in course. This more reserved way. Then you look at even within Europe, and then you look at the more like Mediterranean, southern place, people are more loose and open and extroverted and social kind of, but as a default. So I think that in the UK, it's kind of like, because people are so reserved and don't express themselves so much and so on, that alcohol sort of is an overcorrection. I think it helps people to get out of what's the word I'm looking for? Inhibition, right? I think people are quite socially and culturally inhibited here. And so people like to overdrink as an overcorrection, so that, okay, cool, it's the weekend, let's go out on the lash, let's do that. Whereas I think in places where on a day-to-day basis, people are more open and outgoing and uninhibited and so on, that they feel kind of less need to drink. You know, that people drink everywhere for the most part, but they don't need to go so far, because they're not overcorrecting so much. That's my theory.
Yes. I think that's a pretty good theory, because even when you think of the language that is used around alcohol, which is what it is, alcohol, what it does, it lowers your inhibitions, right?
Yes.
So I think even when you think of it in that way, I don't think that's far-fetched at all.
And if you look at other countries that have, you know, one place I've been to where I think the binge drinking was even worse than the UK is Iceland. Go to Reykjavik on a weekend. Holy crap, man. I was like, I thought people... Yeah. But it's cold, it's dark, it's isolated, right? So, and again, Icelandic people as a cult, they're quite reserved and so on. And then you look at Russia, right? Russia, people are known for being cold climate, colder people, colder overall. And so people literally drink to stay warm there. But I think that there's more drinking because they're overcorrecting, and there seems to be There does seem to literally be a connection between the climate, like both the geographic uh-huh. climate and the social climate, and the culture and alcohol is the way alcohol is treated is a part of this. It's not, I don't think it's a perfect rule, but I think it's a noticeable correlation.
I've never thought about it like that. I've never thought about it like that, especially the climate piece. And I think that's actually, I want to be looking into that because I find that so fascinating. Because
I don't know if it's been studied. I've traveled a lot and I've noticed these patterns.
Yes, because I've had so many people, of course, in my own sobriety journey, even prior to speak about alcohol, whether it's through a cultural lens, but I don't think I've ever heard that piece around the climate. And as you said, I'm like, yeah, of course, that actually makes sense. Food for thought.
It'd be interesting to know if people drink more in the winter. I would assume that they do.
Yes.
But yes. I'm not sure. But I think if you can show people drink more in the winter, that might even lend more credence to it. Because I think in the summer, people are just kind of out and about and doing things and they're less isolated. It's more social.
Yes.
But I don't know. Someone can study that. That's one for somebody to do a study on, maybe.
Right. Yeah. and you know what? Just to close on that, it's reminding me of a lot of things I've been reading about the past 2 years being in lockdown, how much people have turned to alcohol within that time. Mm. So the moment that you were talking about people being isolated and, you know, where that drives people to go, that's one of the biggest things that has happened in the last 2 years. And I'm talking about just here specifically in the UK. I haven't had a chance to look elsewhere, but a lot of people now have huge problems with alcohol because of being isolated, because of being in lockdown. And I remember at the beginning, if you look at the first 3 to 6 months, a lot of people were sort of just thinking of it as fun, right? People were starting to drink more, having drinking parties with friends on Zoom, but it sort of took a darker turn when people realized that actually this is going to be going on for much longer than they thought. So I've actually been hearing a lot of stories of people that have developed some alcohol problems within the last 2 years because they didn't have access to other people. They couldn't connect with other people. Maybe even their rituals of going to the pub and not necessarily having to drink, that sort of brought them home with them. And yeah, so I think, just when I think about everything that's happened in the past couple of years, alcohol is also something that I think about, or just substance abuse in general, and what has happened to people because of that forced isolation for such a long time.
People deal and cope with these things in different ways. Some people turn to food. That's been another problem. Yes. Some people turn to alcohol. Some people turn to harder drugs. Some people turn to, you know, and there's positive and productive things people can turn towards as well. That's where I always keep my focus. But that was one of my, I was obviously very outspoken about the lockdowns and all the other policies from the beginning, but that was one of my greatest concerns because we are, as human beings, we're social creatures. We are social beings. We need connection. We need community. We need to interact with each other. We need to see each other's faces and each other's smiles. We need to be able to laugh. We need to be able to make eye contact. And this is the thing. I think that what's weird about this time we live in is people want a study for everything, right? People want an RCT for everything, right? Until a scientist or an expert has come out with a study and they've run this for, I was like, guys, of course there are going to be negative repercussions. Like, I mean, if you think, if someone is a savage criminal, violent criminal, and they're in prison and they do something messed up in prison, how do you punish that person even further? You put them in solitary confinement. You isolate them. So someone who's already being punished, if you want to make it really rough for them, you say, okay, well, you can't even talk to anyone else. You can't even see. And it drives people crazy. I mean, the notion that you could do that to people for weeks, months on end, up to a year in some places, and that there isn't going to be a catastrophic effect, both on their physical and their mental well-being, to me was just crazy. And people were like, oh, well, you know, you're not a doctor. You don't have studies. I'm like, guys, we need human interaction. Even the most introverted person, I'm an extrovert, but even an introverted person, you need those connections, touching people, like hugging people.
Right.
I can't pull up a study that tells you that hugs and physical, like that hugging, actually maybe someone has studied this, right? But, you know, I'm not aware of something that says, oh, you know, that can quantify the importance of me being able to see your face right now in terms of the conversation. We know if we both put a mask on right now, right? Our ability to connect with each other and have this conversation would decrease by how much?
Rapidly.
By how much? I don't know. How much it affects my mood and your mood? I don't know, but I wouldn't be able to read. Wait, is she smiling? Is she laughing?
Yeah.
Does she want to say something? Is she right? Like I can look at you and I can see, okay, cool. Like, and everyone we interact with, whether it's someone you're just walking past on the street or you're having a conversation, it's so important. And I feel like all of that was just thrown away. It wasn't even considered. And now people are talking about it. But I remember back in 2020, 2021, I was like, guys, all of this is, are you considering? Firstly, we don't even know that this is working or helping in terms of what you're claiming it's trying to deal with. But secondly, what about the downstream effects socially, physically, childhood development, mental health, physical health, the economy, inflation, unemployment, all of these things that are now people are talking about and are like, oh my gosh, we've got a mental health crisis and we've got a cost of living crisis and we've got, it's been kind of maddening for me because I was talking about all that literally early 2020 and I was just like, guys, this is, you can do this for a very, very short time, right? Two weeks, you know, 2 weeks to slow the spread or flatten it, right? That is maybe, you know, 2 weeks might be about the max that you can do this without people starting to go loopy. But the longer you keep this going on for, the worse it's going to get. And I was also concerned, and I'm still seeing this, that some people are never going to get out of this cycle because we adapt. People adapt to things and you get used to things. And remember when everyone, people were literally scared, even when the, you know, stuff calms down, people are still afraid to go out. I mean, I've traveled, UK is not bad, but I can tell you, even in some places in the USA, there's some places where it's like the Rona never even existed. There are still places you can go in the US and people are still walking around with masks outside. They're still wearing them in the gym. They're still distancing from me right now. Yeah. Right. People wearing masks in the gym and stuff. And I've just seen this last, I was there just the last couple of weeks and I'm just like, yo, this is like, they've really damaged a percentage of the population. I think is just permanently damaged from this.
Yes. I agree with that. And I've been speaking to, a lot of people, and I get messages from a lot of people that say that over the past 2 years, they've developed, what is it again? Agoraphobia?
Agoraphobia.
Yes,
fear to go outside and be involved.
Right. That's a huge thing, especially with children. And as you're saying, a lot of people are starting to have these conversations now, but they will only allow for those conversations to be had by self-appointed experts. So you will still find that the average person, even 2 to 3 years on, because it's going to be nearly 3 years very soon, still trying to have that conversation. I think people experience some, I don't know, is it cognitive dissonance or just this thing of you shouldn't be talking about this out loud because you might make other people. It's so bizarre. And I think something that I would like to know just from you, because as you were saying, it makes me curious. What from the beginning, though, do you think made you feel like you had to speak in the way you were? Because I guess, especially in the beginning, it must have been very hard, though, in early 2020 to be so convicted.
It was not popular. It was not popular.
Yeah, not at all.
I was called a grandma killer. People said I was putting, you know, my words were going to put people at risk and get people killed. There are people claiming, you know, I don't care about people. I only care about the economy. I'm putting the economy over human lives, this and that, you know. And then, of course, later down the line comes the, you know, you're an anti-vaxxer, you're an anti-this, you're pro-COVID, all of these things. And it's like, no, I'm just looking at this holistically. Right. Because I don't, with many things in the world, I don't view things as all or nothing. I recognize that things are trade-offs, right? And people don't like to think in terms of trade-offs and costs, right? Especially if you're looking in the world of anything social, cultural, let alone political, it's all trade-offs, right? You put in a policy, okay, it might have these potential benefits, it might have these potential costs. These are the things that we know, these are the things that we don't know. And so on. And with the way that I said from, I think from March 2020, I think in March 2020, I put out a tweet saying that the response is, the consequences of the response are going to be worse than the consequences of the virus itself, right? Mm. Because the level of, people were not scared into their wits, they were scared out of their wits, right? It's not a bad thing for people to be aware of what's out there and have a level of concern and risk, but it has to be, it has to be balanced. It has to be moderated, right? I mean, if I met someone who is afraid to go outside because they could be hit by lightning, or even that they could get sick, they could get a cold, they could get a flu, or you never get in a car, you never get on a plane because it could crash. I mean, I support your right to do that. If you never want to get in a car and you never want to fly in a plane, I will 100% fight against anyone trying to force you into a car or force you on a plane. I also think that your risk analysis is crazy and that you're going to miss out on so much in life by yes. being so risk averse, right? We live in a risky world. We always have. We've all gotten sick before, right? Our entire lives. I'm sure you've had colds, you've had flus and so on, and you got it from someone, right? Technically, anytime you go out, or even if you stay indoors, something could happen. But right. as an adult, we generally accept, okay, look, there are risks out there, but if you are going to have some semblance of liberty and freedom, then you need to allow people to take risks, right? We were talking before about alcohol, okay? So yes. I would never advocate that, oh, the UK should just ban alcohol. I mean, you could, mm-hmm. using the logic that people have been using for the past 2.5 years, you can advocate for alcohol bans, cigarette bans, reducing the speed limit to 30 miles per hour, whatever it may be. Oh, you're against that. What? You don't care about people? You don't care about human right. lives? Do you not know how many people die from alcohol? Do you know how many people die from car accidents? Why don't you want to reduce the speed limit to 30 miles per hour? And the answer is because there's a trade-off, right? There's a trade-off. Yes. So if you reduce the speed limit to 30, yes, you could reduce, you would absolutely reduce traffic accidents and fatalities by a significant margin, right? But what problems would you cause? Now every journey yes. takes 2 to 3 times as long as it did before. What does that mean for logistics? What does that mean for the truckers who deliver food and groceries to stores right. around the country? What does that mean for people's commutes? What does it mean for this and that? And so we accept, okay, having the speed limit at 70, this, you know, if you get in an accident at that speed, you know, that could be bad, but you know, you're not being forced to drive. And these are the risks. You can also drive below that limit if you want to, right? We're just saying this is a maximum. So with everything in our society, we analyze trade-offs. We think of, okay, and you know, maybe sometimes we get it right, sometimes we get it wrong. It changes over time. And the thing to answer your question, it's just like, I was noticing that all of this just went out the window. What about basic yes. rights? Since when right. can the government tell you that you can't go outside, that you can't see your family, that you have to close your business, that you can't go to the store, that all of the gyms need to be shut down? It should have been, look, here's our guidance. This is what we know. This is what we don't know. This is our guidance. I wouldn't even have been against if they put out a strong recommendation that people stay at home or mm-hmm. a recommendation that you don't do this or you don't. But for me, it was the force. It was the coercion. Yes. It was the complete disregard me of people's too. Choices, people's freedoms, people's rights. It's just like, and also the one size fits all nature of the messaging. It was like, look, let's be real. This is a virus, and it was known from early. It was known literally from about April time that yes. primarily the people dying were 65 and older with multiple comorbidities. Children, nope. Teenagers, nope. Young adults, healthy young adults, nope, they're fine. You know, middle-aged, maybe if you've got some bad comorbidities and so on, mm-hmm. you might have, right? So it's very age stratified. This isn't one of those things where it's like, okay, no matter who you are, no matter your age, no matter your health condition, yes. this is very... And that was known from early. And it was like, well, that should be the messaging. Give people the facts, give people the info, give people the statistics, and let people make those decisions, right? I know myself and my family situation, and I certainly care more about myself and my family situation than any politician does out there. They don't yes. even know who we are. They don't know our names. There have been, you know, every year, tens of thousands of people die from the flu, right? It happens. It sucks. You know, it sucks. And then on top of this, one more thing, just while we're on this point, is also two more. Let me do two more, actually. One is that you cannot stop this type of virus, right? You can't stop it in its tracks. It's why we can't get rid of the flu, right?
Yes.
We can't get rid of it. We've never been able to, because there are certain types of viruses, coronaviruses in particular, which it's airborne. It's just out there, colds, flus. So it's just out there. And so some people are going to get sick. So I was just like, okay, well, if it's that contagious, you know, people are going to get it. And actually early on, if you remember, they did kind of say that, because the thing was about flattening the curve. The lockdowns were, you know, they said that they needed to get more PPE and they didn't want too many people getting sick at the same time. They never claimed it was going to reduce the number of people who got it. And then they kept shifting the goalpost. And then finally, on a sort of deeper, more philosophical level, prior to any of this happening, I've been very, very aware and cognizant of the power of fear, the power of propaganda, and groupthink, right? And when these things combine, I've looked in many incidents that have happened throughout history. Obviously, people bring up, you know, the Holocaust and, you know, the Holodomor. But more recently, what about the Rwandan genocide? There are many, many examples, right? We've heard about things like the Milgram experiment, the Ash experiment, the Stanford Prison experiment. I've looked into all of these things well before there was any pandemic situation. I've read the Gulag Archipelago. I've read Ordinary Men. I read them before this thing happened. So when it started to kick off and I started to see this people forming in this group and there's one line and you're not allowed to quit, I was like, ooh, okay, this is it in real life. This is it in real life, right? Yeah. I cannot just fall into this thing. Like, I have to ring the alarm and go, wait, guys, what about this? What about this? Are you thinking about this? Are you considering this? And in the hysteria, in the fear, how do people respond? Oh, you just want people to die. You don't care about people. You're selfish. You're this, you're that. It's like, no, I'm just trying to consider the bigger picture. You're looking at this very, very narrow part of it. You're looking at, okay, just this one virus. It's like, you know, people die of other things. Like, here's a crazy stat. Let's do some math here. What's the claim of how many people globally in the past 2.5 years died of the virus? Is it about six million?
I think it's about 6 million. Yeah.
About 6 million. About 6 million in 2.5 years. Do you know how many people die in an average year globally?
Mm-mm. I don't.
About 60 million. So it would be fair to say that in the past 2.5 years, about 150 million people have died of other things. So people will go to me and go, yeah, but Zuby, like, you know, come on, man, like 6 million people. I'm like, bro, do you know how many people die per year? Right? You've never even thought of that before, right? It's never even come to your brain to think, okay, 6 million sounds like, you know, let's say it's 2 million in 1 year or 3 million in 1 year. That sounds like a bit, but okay, number one, what was the average age of death? It was over 75. Okay, the average age of death was over 75, right? A 75-year-old dying, it's not the same as a 7-year-old dying, right? 75-year-olds do die, sadly. We don't live forever. But also, it's like, well, what about everything else? And why do people don't even know that other number. People don't even care. Why is someone dying from this particular virus considered worse or than someone dying of cancer or heart disease or suicide or this or that or some other things which are being exacerbated by the policies, right? And no one cared. It was just so myopic. So that was the thing that even to this day, it was just like people have snapped out of the psychosis mostly now. But that was the thing that I was just like, guys, you're not. I see what you're seeing as well, but there's a much bigger picture here. There's a much bigger picture that we need to really consider, right? Because if you're going to advocate for this, you have to consider the trade-offs. You can't just be doing all of this and acting like, oh, well, there's no downside. It's all good. Let's just keep doing it. We don't even know if it's working, but it makes people feel, and it's just like, man, like, this is, it got very gnarly. I'm glad that it's calming down now, but it got really, really weird.
Me too. Yeah. And you know what? I actually got introduced to you and your work and your voice in mid to late 2020. And it was
Oh,
at
okay.
the time when I was, and it was at the time when I was breaking out of my own echo chambers. I was actually always on the same page as you probably were, definitely were actually, in terms of COVID and lockdown and everything that was happening. I made a commitment to myself that I was going to live my life, that I was not going to allow the news to dictate. And I've never been that kind of person anyway, but because of the level of fear that I could feel, and almost as if I was being coerced to be fearful, even though I didn't feel it and I didn't believe it. And I could hold multiple truths, right? I could acknowledge what is happening around us, but I could also say, okay, this doesn't seem quite right. And because I've worked in advertising before, I know the power of language and how language is used to weaponize and to control a majority of people, to control a nationality, etc. So when it comes to COVID, I didn't even buy into that fear so much, but I found your work and your voice at a time when I needed it the most, when I bought into a certain ideology and narrative in terms of race. So that's where my moment of being like, I was on board. I was on board with you, but now you have lost me. I don't quite know how and why you have lost me, but
Love this. Tell me
that's where
more.
I was. Oh yeah, that's where I was. That feeling of something very sinister and disturbing is happening right now, and I know what I'm being told to think. I know what I'm seeing. But none of this is making sense. It seems to be going against everything these people say they want. And I was experiencing, and I was caught up in the immense division that most people probably felt in May, June, July of 2020, especially in relation to race. And that's when I came across your work. And I remember in the beginning being quite,
Do you remember what you saw?
I wouldn't even be able to remember exactly what I saw because I think it was actually what you were speaking about in relation to COVID. But for some reason, it made sense and related to the conversations around race that were happening. But you were mainly driving the point home around how we need to be able to question things, how we need to look at things through a lens of nuance and acknowledge context instead of taking things hook, line, and sinker. And it just made perfect sense when I was thinking about everything that was pouring out of the US and here in the UK, it was landing and people were out on the streets protesting. Here in the UK, we were being told that the police here in the UK who don't carry guns are gunning down black people. So a lot of things just didn't quite make sense. So I found it didn't quite, you know, but I found your message when I needed it the most. And I remember it actually landing exactly where it needed to for me, but it also felt quite jarring. And it felt very jarring because I wasn't used to seeing people speaking in that way, or at least my algorithm and the information that I was choosing to take in was not allowing voices like yours to enter my sphere. I was very, without even realizing on a subconscious level, I was very intentional about making sure that I don't allow anything in that is going to cause me cognitive dissonance, that is going to make me have to sit with my current beliefs and my current worldview and have to work some things out. So your voice, amongst the many that I ended up finding after, was actually very important because at that time, Zuby, especially mid-2020 and early 2020, it was not like it is now, where you come across more people that are willing to have conversations around self-censorship, willing to question things. At that time, there was so much to lose, if you will. The risk was so high. And that's why I just had to ask you, what was it that made you, despite everyone else going in one direction, what was it that made you stand and what was actually true for you? What made you fiercely stand in integrity? Because I just remember how intense it was at that time. It's almost like it's another world now. When I look at it retrospectively, I'm almost mind blown that all of that took place. And I don't think we've even come out of it properly yet. I feel like we're still just, there's still the residue of it, you know. I think in a few years, maybe 5 years' time, we'll be looking at it in absolute shock. So yeah, voices like yours, and when I came across your work, it actually really drove me and fueled me to speak in the way that I do today, in a way that I always have, but just in a different way. And I think it's also what encouraged me to feel like, you know what, I can put all of my unthinkable thoughts in this open letter, and there are people. And I think especially the fact that you were from the UK, also, I loved that a lot because I think sometimes we hear conversations like this mainly coming out of the US. So I think sometimes it can be a very North American lens to some of these conversations. So I actually appreciated that you were from the UK and that you've had the life experience that you've had and that you're able to look at things in a really multidimensional way. But yeah, to speak in the way you do at that time, I experienced it myself. It was not easy. It was not brandable. It was not marketable. It was not a thing. It just wasn't. It just wasn't. No.
Yeah, well, thank you. I'm honored. I'm happy. I'm happy that my words have been able to do that and to
Yes.
encourage and embolden other people, because it's part of the reason and I'm sure you feel this way now as well. It's part of the reason why I feel a necessity to, it's part of why I feel a necessity to speak up, because I know it does encourage and embolden other people, sometimes directly,
Yes.
sometimes indirectly. Because a lot of my message is not about, I've said this before, which is that I don't want to tell people what to think. I do want to tell people to think, right? So whenever there is something going on where there's a really strong groupthink and your questioning is discouraged, personal individual thinking is discouraged, the so-called experts are not wanting to answer anything, people are encouraging deplatforming and censorship and this and that. That always that sets off real alarm bells for me, because I'm like, wait, we should always be able to have conversations. There should always be dialogue. You should always be allowed to dissent, even if this isn't just like dissent I agree with, right? But it like you should just be a, these are very basic tenets of what actually made Western society what it is, right? Allowing free thought, allowing discussion, allowing dissent, allowing people to question things and so on. And it can be uncomfortable. I understand that, right? There's things that I have deeply held beliefs too. I don't love people, you know. No one loves their beliefs being, you know, questioned or put to the test. So I understand the imperative. I'm not someone who even struggles. I'm very pro free speech. I'm very anti-censorship, but I'm not someone who struggles to understand the censorious urge, right? Because I think that's a natural inclination. Whoever you are, whatever your beliefs are, if you hear someone who is questioning or challenging things, let alone you know, mocking or attacking things that you hold dearly, it could be your political beliefs, it could be your religious beliefs, your cultural beliefs, something you feel about yourself or your country, it's not comfortable. It's not pleasant. The natural desire is we need to shut that person up. That person should not be allowed to say what they're saying. Now, look, there are levels where stuff is, you know, hyper egregious, right? If someone is, you know, calling for death of an individual, or, you know, putting out threats, or, you know, right, there's levels of stuff where it's like, okay, wait, like that's way, way, way beyond. But something that's just a, you know, a dissenting opinion, a challenge, an alternative viewpoint, my reaction is like, why do you think that way? Right? So even with people who are my sort of critics are funny, because oftentimes they criticize things that I don't believe and that I haven't said, right? They have this sort of straw man image of you, or this caricature of you, where, okay, Zuby's the guy who believes that. And I'm like, where did you even get that from? Have you actually paid attention, or are you just, right? And so, but if someone has like a legit criticism, I'm like, okay, interesting. Why, even if it's not a legitimate criticism, I'm like, okay, why do you think, what do you think I'm wrong about on that? Right? Like I'm open to it. I don't know everything. Every day I'm learning, every day I'm getting better. But that happens because we're allowed to have dialogue, because dissent is allowed, communication is allowed. And so on any subject, doesn't matter if it's the pandemic response, if it's racial issues, if it's political issues, if it's religious issues. I'm like, yo, we've got to be able to talk. We've got 8 billion yes. people in this world. There are no two people who share the exact same beliefs and opinions on everything. That does not exist. You can take the two closest people, they could love it, they could be in the same family, they could be raised the same. You're going to get differences, you're going to get dissent. And so if we want to actually live in a tolerant and peaceful and diverse, let's use those words, right, community and society, then we need to be able to tolerate people. We need to be able to be actually empathetic. And even with those we disagree with, go, okay, I disagree with that, but I understand why you think like that. I get where yes. you're coming from. We might reach a different conclusion, right? But here's one more thought I've had. Well, let me finish on this point. I think one issue that we're having is that, and I think social media does this a lot, where people start with people's conclusions and work backwards, right? So we're missing a lot of the epistemology of why and how people think what they think, right? So I don't think it's necessarily the most important thing to understand what someone's final conclusion on a particular issue is. I think what's more interesting and what's more telling is how they reach there. And in most situations, right? So there could be an issue where I reach conclusion A, you reach conclusion B. But we might find, you know, in this 10-step process of thinking, we only diverge at the 8th point, right? Mm-hmm. So up until from the beginning, but what people are doing now is if someone reaches conclusion A and they reach conclusion B, they assume it's because from the very beginning, you diverged, right? And that divergence is oftentimes simply good and evil, right? So it's just good and evil, right? So if, for example, let's take something that's not too contentious, right? I think that taxes should be lower, and someone else thinks that taxes should be higher. The urge online is to assume that I want taxes to be lower because I'm selfish and I hate poor people and I want the roads to be crap and I don't want there to be healthcare and I don't want to, and I hate homeless people, right? So they're just, it's because he's evil, right? He wants taxes lower because he's evil. It's like, wait, hang on. Let's go through the epistemology of this, right? Like we probably agree up until this point, we probably diverge where it comes to who should do it. You might think the government should take care of this. I might think individuals, corporations, the free market, and charities should take care of this particular situation, right? Maybe, right? You could take one of those issues. You could take just homelessness, right? And someone's like, we need to raise the taxes and tax it because we need to take care of homeless. And it's like, wait. I disagree. I don't disagree that homeless people have just as much dignity and equality under the law and should be taken up. I think homelessness is a horrible thing. I don't think that the government is the best mechanism to take care of this past a certain level. And I think that the government have proven this over multiple decades because they've got all these billion-pound budgets and the problem is getting worse. So clearly they don't care or they're incompetent. But on every single issue, and you see it with it could be the immigration issue. It could literally be any issue.
Anything.
And I think that's why dialogue is so important. So if someone hears me say, I think this BLM thing's a scam. What? You don't think like right? You don't believe that Black Lives? It's like, bro, look at my fam. Do you think that's a logical conclusion? That's my reason for disagreeing is right. Why do you say, okay, why do you think like that? And I can walk you through, my thinking process and we'll probably agree with a lot. There'll come a point where we diverge, but we'll agree with a lot of the points. And I think that when this is a big problem that's leading to increased political polarization, especially, you know, with this whole like left, right divide where, you know, people on the right are thinking that, okay, well, they're just evil. We're good. They're evil. People on the left are thinking, okay, well, we are good and they're evil, because you're just assuming that everyone has bad motives. Everyone has bad intentions. I have never met anyone who wants more crime. I've never met anyone who wants more homelessness. I've never met anyone who wants more people to die and more people. Like that's not a position. I've never heard someone who wants more police brutality. I don't care. Left, right, up, down. I've never heard anyone advocate that position. I've never heard anyone say that Black lives don't matter. I've never heard anyone say that.
Me neither. Right?
And so it's this, it's just straw manning all the way down. And it's like, well, this is why we can't have conversations, because if you're just going to assume that the other person is just evil or stupid or uneducated off the bat, rather than listening to them and going, okay, let's hear what you have to say, even if it's uncomfortable, and we can go, okay, this is the point. This is the point where we diverge. That point you said there, I don't agree with that. Here's my thoughts on it. And even if you walk away still disagreeing, you at least understand, okay, that's why that person thinks like that. And that's why there's perhaps millions of people who think like that.
Yes. And something that I'm always thinking about is that communication piece, because something most people will say is that we need to have more open conversations. We need to allow for more dialogue, et cetera, et cetera. And of course, I completely agree. That's at the core of the work that I do. But then I am often finding myself thinking about the how. How do we do that? Because I think our digital lives are now such a big part of our lives that we immediately assume that we need to be trying to have those conversations online. I don't see many people prioritizing having those difficult conversations. And they don't always have to be difficult, just open, honest, authentic conversations, the questioning, the curiosity, the reflection. We should be trying to have those in our interpersonal relationships. I think where a lot of people can end up feeling like, okay, where do we even begin? How is this going to happen? Is when we start believing that we need to be having those conversations online, and we're trying to have them on platforms that actually don't allow for nuance. We're having them on platforms that incentivize outrage, that force you to speak in a very limited way, and people react. Those platforms are not for responding. They're designed for reaction, right? Mm-hmm. So something that I have been thinking about a lot now, which is why I've been in a place of just observation and silence and really trying to understand on a much deeper level how we can actually make this communication piece more practical, is the how. And something that I always come back to, and I wonder what you think, but I think it's, there needs to be more of a focus on the individual, in the sense that I think this is a lot about you rewiring your own mindset, rewiring and having a close look at your own worldview, allowing yourself to interact with different ideas, different thoughts, and almost working at yourself on the individual level, and then bringing that into your interpersonal relationships without making online sharing or public sharing a priority, which is where I think most people believe that they have to start. That's a piece that I'm constantly thinking about, as in how can we actually start to bring solutions to this idea of having more open conversations and open communication, which I think is fantastic, but I think it can still be quite vague how we actually practically do that without prioritizing doing it online.
Yeah, I hear that totally. I think first of all, it's a challenge. I think it always has been and always will be. We're never going to get it perfect. But with that said, I actually, even though the environment has become a little bit more censorious in some ways, I actually think that it's better now than it was a few years ago. I think it's improved. I think that on multiple levels, I think there are more people who are talking and doing podcasts like this and having conversations. That's happening in the UK. It's happening in the US. It's happening across the world. I think that some of the narratives that we were discussing are being broken down, right? The sort of mindless narratives of, you know, this is the only one view allowed on this stuff, right? You're now allowed to completely question the entire pandemic narrative and criticize the response, and you can do that now, and it's fine. Like, I remember in 2020, the amount of vitriol I got for saying some of this stuff, like, it was, people were saying some really, really nasty things, and I was like, whoa, like, this is crazy. You talked about, you know, the post George Floyd era and the hysteria that came with that on multiple levels, and right, that's calmed down now. Right now, people are like, oh, okay, there is an organization called BLM, and you know, there's this, and there's actually there's some corruption going. You can now question it. You can challenge. So, you know, even the whole what people call woke ideology, it's being challenged more now. It's being questioned more now. The whole gender ideology, it's being questioned. The racial narratives, it's being questioned. Parents are found out when their kids were homeschooling some of the stuff that they were learning and being taught. And so now parents, especially in the States, homeschooling has shot up by millions. There's more people going, okay, homeschooling rates have gone significantly up in the USA, many more millions. And so to me, that is all positive. That's all good, because that is, you are quote unquote allowed to question and challenge, right? And I, like I said before, I want people to be thinking. I don't want people to be marching in lockstep. I'm not trying to be this guy who's like creating some cult and everyone must follow me and believe exactly what I believe. I'm just like, no, like I try to lead by example, right? So I'm like, look, I'm having these conversations. And also when I'm online, sometimes I kick the hornet's nest a little bit and I put out certain jokes or whatever, but I'm not intentionally just a provocateur, right? I'm not someone who's just there trolling and trying to get a reaction and trying to just, you know, own the libs. I could do that. I could grow my following quicker if I just became this sort of firebrand and just, but it's like, look, I'm not trying to raise the temperature. I'm not trying to add to more division and create more hostility. And I know, millions of people see my interactions every day, especially on Twitter. So I have to carry myself in a certain manner and lead by example, right? So I don't randomly attack or insult people ever, right? Even when people do, I'm respectful with people. I'm civil. So if someone comes at me completely sideways, once in a while, I may air them out. But even then, I'll do it in a sort of fairly graceful way. I'll do it in a much nicer way than necessarily they're deserving. So I just try to lead by example. It's why I'm a big fan of, I love what you're doing. I love what, I love what Joe Rogan is doing. I love what they're doing with trigonometry. Just look, let's talk. Let's have these conversations. We're going to agree. We're going to disagree. Cause I think modeling is very important. And I think this is one thing that is getting worse in politics. Like, I'm not someone who looks to politicians to be my role models at all, but I think that if you look at the way politicians interact with each other, it's really declined. It's become a lot more childish, right? When I'm on Twitter and I'm seeing elected representatives, whether in the UK or and they're trash talking each other and they're insulting each other and they're calling each other names. And it's very childish. It's almost like watching 14-year-old boys, kind of going back and forth. And I'm like, this is not a good example, right? This is not a good example. I would honestly say, I've said openly that if I were American, I would have voted for Trump, but this is one of my biggest criticisms of it. By the way, I don't think Biden is better at this. I think a lot of them, they're not professional in the way that they're conducting themselves. I think they're setting a poor example for what social and political discourse should look like.
Agreed.
Right? People on the left are doing it. People on the right are doing it. And I'm like, you're not. And then of course you're going to get your fans and your supporters, and they're going to some degree, they're going to mimic that. Right. And they're just going to be going at that side and going at that side. And I'm like, well, if you think of what the goal of, on paper anyway, right? Like, the goal of even having politics and having politicians is to represent the people, right? If you are an American politician, you're the president, you're a congressperson, you're a mayor, you're a governor, you're the British prime minister, your goal shouldn't just be to represent the right or represent the left or represent just the progressives. You are supposed to represent the country. Yes, you will have your own leanings, you'll have your own constituents and so on, but you're not meant to just, okay, I've got this 30%, like the rest of the other 70% of the country, F them. Let's even antagonize them. Let's go against them. Let's make it clear we don't like them, right? I'm like, you can represent your values and your beliefs and your quote unquote side without being super hostile towards everybody else, right? So I'm a Christian. I was raised a Christian, right? And I can put out that message to some degree, and I can lead by example, and I can tell people what I believe in. I can do that without being a complete jerk to everybody of every other religion or no religion. In fact, I would argue that I represent what a Christian is better by not doing so. If I'm just like, oh, yes. Well, this is what I believe and I'm right, and you're all stupid and you're all this and you're all that and you're all that, then it's like, oh, wow, look at this arrogant. No. It doesn't matter if it's religion, if it's politics, if it's any, you don't want to be that person who's just hyper intolerant and arrogant and just has this level of hubris and, oh, I'm, of course, everything I know is correct and therefore everyone else is just an idiot. It's like, no, I can be respectful of other people and also be interested. I'm cool. I want to know what you believe. Like, I'm intrigued. Yes. Why are there many different religions? What are the differences between Judaism and Islam and Christianity? And, you know, how come they believe this over here and we believe this? Okay, there's a lot of stuff that we share, but we diverge on this. I'm genuinely interested in human beings. It's like, I want to understand. I don't have all the answers. I can learn something from everybody. So cool, let's talk, let's learn something.
Right, and you know what? You've just articulated why it is that I resonate with your work and a handful of other people. Because when I was breaking out of my own echo chambers and I was coming across voices that were both very refreshing, but also in the truest sense of the word, triggering, because it led me into cognitive dissonance and I had to face it and I had to sit with myself, I had to self-reflect. I came across a lot of voices that were very, and I'm sure they would even refer to themselves as anti-woke, for example. And in the beginning, they were putting out messages that I needed to hear. Even though I didn't agree with everything, I didn't need to. I just needed something that would break the spell of everything I had been taking in for that past year. And I quickly realized that a lot of people were finding themselves in a performance where they knew that they, by speaking in a certain way, by being as controversial as possible, by taking a very strong, and I'll just stick with that example of the anti-woke, so to speak, they knew that by really harping this very divisive, controversial message that gets people excited, it gives people this kind of joy because they found someone who can speak for them in the way that they wouldn't ever. They knew that would get them more of a following, because you can easily build a very strong echo chamber, especially at that time, yes, when people needed people that were going against everything that we were seeing that would be labeled as woke ideology. People needed those people that are like, no, we are not sticking with this. This is what is wrong. This is what it is. And I realized that a lot of people were starting to find themselves out of integrity. I don't know if they were ever were in integrity, but I could see that there were people that were willing to create some kind of persona because they knew that they would be rewarded for the persona. And there were a handful of people, and I believe you were one of those people, who I could tell didn't have a problem with being direct, didn't have a problem with saying what it is that they can see, but they were focusing on the behavior instead of the individual and putting people into one group. And I think that's what I find and continuously do find very refreshing about what it is you do. Because I have found that some people have just started to fall into the exact same behavior that they claim to oppose. They claim to be against intolerance, but they are incredibly intolerant themselves. Against cancel culture, but they will celebrate cancel culture if someone they don't like is canceled. So I think this is something that I've been seeing for the past couple of years. And I think when it comes to people that are having conversations like you and I, for me, there actually aren't that many people that I can say this person is truly in integrity. They are building their platform. They now do have a following, but they're still staying in integrity with themselves. I think I'm seeing more people starting to kind of lean into that anti-woke persona. And I've just always been very intentional, actually, from the very beginning of doing the work that I do in my open letter, that I don't want to fall into either side. I don't want to break out of an echo chamber and go straight into another one. I really want to be intentional with what it is that I do. I want to look at the behavior, not the people. I don't want to call every single person a sheep. I don't want to fall into the trap of using language that actually doesn't mean much, and it can people are losing credibility by falling into this very divisive language, you know. And that's why I find it so refreshing when I come across people who can still be fierce in their message, who can still be very direct and will not mince their words, but they won't fall into that trap of the division. And I think it's getting quite hard to find those people, I think.
Yeah, it's hard. It's especially hard over time, because it's a lot easier to only be, it's a lot easier to only get attacked by one side rather than both.
Yes.
Right. So it's a lot easier to just go, it's easier to go full woke or full anti-woke or full left or full right. And, you know, you've clearly got your team and you've got your opponent. And your team backs you and your opponent. If you're hovering, even if you're not dead center, but you're willing to call out some nonsense from both sides, or you're willing to just kind of remain free and not have this hard allegiance, then you will get stick. You do get stick from both people, right? You know, I've had stick for, you're not... Right. There are people who even we talked a little bit about the pandemic thing, right? You know, because there are people who don't even think that the virus exists, and that there are people who are, you know, I'm not an actual anti-vaxxer. Like, you know, I've never been called that ever prior to about a year ago. Right. Vaccines in general. Right. Good ones, good effective ones. Right. I've never had a problem with or anything. I was just against I'm against coercion. I'm against mandates. I'm against, you know, running over people's civil liberties and bullying people and so on. But there are people who are, you know, like really, really deep down the sort of anti-vax rabbit hole, and, you know, the actual, like, real deep conspiracy theorist rabbit holes who, you know, will call me a shill or a grifter, right? They're mad that I'm not just completely opposed to the whole thing, or they're mad that I don't think that viruses don't even exist, right? Because they believe in just terrain theory. So they're like, oh, you believe, he believes virus. And I'm like, dude, like, I'm not all the way there. It's like, I'm not all the way. And both of y'all are just as annoying. But looping back around to something you said, here's something that I think is really important for people to know. And I believe it is much better and much healthier to define yourself and your message by what you are for rather than what you're against.
Yes.
I think as soon as you start identifying with and describing yourself by what you are opposed to, rather than what you support and what you believe and what you think is good for society, then you're now in a weird position, right? I think anti-racists fall into this, anti-woke falls into this, and as soon as anti-feminist, why I'm very careful to not label myself for the most part as like anti this thing. Cause then over a course of time, as you alluded to earlier, you can end up quite literally becoming what you're fighting against, what you claim to be fighting against. You can start out in 2017 as an anti-racist. By 2020, you are there talking about how white people are the devil, and how this and you're like, whoa, like you see it happen, right? You see it happen with a lot of, you know, self-described feminists. It's one thing to say, hey, you know, I'm a woman's rights advocate, or I'm a champion, or, you know, I'm pro women's rights. But when you become, I'm anti the patriarchy, or I'm anti men, you know, when you see these, they become misandrists, right? They become, oh, wow, this person is just being vitriolic against men in general, speaking very, very broadly.
Right.
Men are trash. Men are this, men are that. And I'm like, whoa, like, if a man were saying that about women, you'd be very, very quick to call that person a misogynist. But listen to what you're saying. If you see a lot of what people are saying about white people, especially white men, I'm like, man, if so, swap the word white man for black woman and see how that sounds. You'd be like, yo, that person is sounding crazy. Like, listen to what they're saying. They're just demonizing and painting with this very, very broad brush. And I'm just like, yeah, well, if it's not cool in that direction, it's not cool in that direction. So how about we all have some principles and don't use that kind of, you know, I'm not here to police people's speech, but, you know, let's be responsible in our speech. Let's talk about right. Let's talk about responsibility as much as we talk about rights.
Right. Agreed. And it's so timely that you say that, because I was having a conversation with a new friend of mine, Kyle, and he was saying the exact same thing about, and he does similar work to you and I, Kyle Creek. He's also known as the Captain Online. I think you would love his work if you're not connected already. And he was saying that his partner was saying that exact same thing to him, saying that your message is infinitely more powerful and more grounded when you speak through the lens of what you are for, not what you are against, because you can easily find yourself becoming so cynical. And that cynicism can end up being a performance, and you get rewarded for that performance, and then you get trapped in this persona. So I really appreciate that you said that again, because I think it's a message that I'm so lucky that I've just ended up embodying in my work anyway. But I think my sobriety and my recovery journey has just led me to a place of really just focusing on what I am for, so that I can not find myself in this hole again. But I think it's so important for anyone listening, actually. And it really allows you to be more expansive in your thinking instead of being so limited. When you think about what am I actually for? I know what I'm against, but do I know and can I actually articulate what I am for and what I'm standing for? And I think it beautifully ties in with values as well. So yeah, I too think that's a very important message.
I just thought of something else as you were saying that. You're absolutely right on that. And to take it even a level further, I think another thing that it does, if you define yourself by what you're against, is you start seeing apparitions of it everywhere.
Yes.
Right?
Yes.
You start seeing it everywhere, right? Yes. So if you are, again, like you use an easy example, you know, you could say, you know, anti-fascist, right? You see, if you're an anti-fascist, you see fascists everywhere. I've never met a fascist, have you?
Never, but apparently they're amongst us. Maybe we are them.
I've never met one. I meet a lot of people. I've met hundreds of thousands of people. I've never met someone, and he's like, I'm like, what are your politics? You know, I'm a fascist. I'm like, whoa, okay, I found one.
Never.
You know, or you know, anti-racist. They see racism every single day, every person they interact with. They're looking. Where's the racism? Right, because they assume it's there. You know, and you can get the same on the other side. You become anti this thing, and it's just it's now everywhere. You're searching for it. You're seeing it where it may not even exist, right? If you become, you know, there's people who, you know, they're so anti woke that they see, I don't know, they see a Marks and Spencer's ad, and it's got a mixed group of people on it, and it triggers them in some way. They're like, oh, why are they all? And I'm like, dude,
yes.
Like, I just saw a group of, like, I'm not convinced that that's a woke ad. I think that's just an ad with a range of people. You see what I mean? But similarly, the anti-racist would see an ad and it's got a white family.
You're
and they're
so
like,
right.
This is white supremacy. It's like, right. No, that's just a family. Like, that's a British family.
And
that's
you are in
average,
Britain.
That's what an average British family actually looks like. Right. You know, and it's weird. You know, people just get very, very upset. You've seen this conversation going on now about, you know, the Little Mermaid. And I'm like,
oh, my goodness.
On both sides. Right. And I'm just like,
on
both
sides.
I'm like, guys, you're arguing over the skin color of a fictitious mermaid in a Disney cartoon that's like 30 something years. I don't even know why y'all are watching these movies to begin with, because they're for children. But it's not. It's not that deep, right? I mean, I can understand when there's like a historical character or something and they do like a complete race swap and it's very, you know, you make Anne Boleyn a black woman.
Right.
Or
that's what
you,
I was thinking.
Or you do, I don't know, if you do a biopic on Nelson Mandela and, you know, you get Brad Pitt to play him.
I think it would
that's
be
a
Michael
bit like,
Fassbender.
Okay, that's, yeah, I was like, all right, that's kind of silly. That's kind of silly, but guys, like, it's a cartoon. Right. Or some people go as far as like who does the voice of a cartoon character.
Oh, that was the whole thing. I remember, didn't the actor from The Simpsons apologize for playing Apu? I mean, it's ridiculous. And you're so right, actually, because when you look at the other side of that, I think this is where just feeling more empowered and in your own sovereignty and autonomy is beautiful, because we've just given examples of that side. When you live your life through the lens of being for against something, there's almost like an underlying commitment to find it everywhere so you can feel like you're fulfilling your duty. The other side of that is when you're actually for something, when you are, for example, you're for open conversations, you're for healthy disagreement, you're for understanding without, and knowing that it doesn't have to mean you accept everything, you just start to live a much more fruitful life, and you're able to relate to other people, knowing that you don't have to take anyone else's worldview as your own. And I think if we just continue to encourage each other to live just from that state of being for something, being for your values, being for openness, whatever that looks like for you, I think you will find a lot of people, even just mentally, in a better mental position, because I think a lot of what we're seeing is leading people into identity crisis. Mm-hmm. People are so unstable. You have the most unstable people just leading movements, being the voices of people. And I think when we start to just detach ourselves from that and look at things through what we're actually for, I've personally found that makes a world of a difference. It really does. It really does.
Africa, it's been amazing talking to you. I definitely want to have you on the podcast again, but I also want to be respectful of your time. What have you got going on that you would like to direct people towards? Is there anything they should be looking out for?
So I think just the one thing that I can mention is my podcast. I do have a podcast called Beyond the Self. It's all about how to focus on what you can control. And for me, the reason why that is so important, especially in the last few years, there are so many things that are happening that are outside of our control, and we're made to focus on those things when there's actually so much that is still within your control. Your own behavior, your worldview is still within your control. How you behave, not just with other people, but also with yourself, your mindset, your identity, the decisions you make, your values. So my podcast really approaches all of those conversations, but I like to go beyond the surface of what we usually get in the self-help industry, self-improvement. And it's very unfiltered. It's very unfiltered from an honest place, not from a self-righteous place. So I would just recommend to just check that out. It's Beyond the Self. And then if anyone wants to continue these conversations with me, I am on Instagram at Africa Brooke with an E at the end. Because these conversations are not me speaking from a platform to everyone else. I like to think of them as I'm on eye level with anyone who wants to continue the conversation with me. So yeah, those are the two places.
Awesome. Africa Brooke, thank you so much for coming on the Real Talk with Zuby podcast. Been an honor and a pleasure speaking with you. I am the man, sick with the slang, sick and I'm destined for fame. Do for the fam, not for the gram, stunt me, destined for pain. I do not front, I do not scam, put some respect on my name. Sick like Cobain, click and I bang, y'all gon' remember the name. Y'all gon' remember the name.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply. When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.